I always remember sitting when one of the groups I was in, we got to number, I think it was number 6 in the chart. It was a big deal. And I'm sitting there going, yay. And then I went, what now? And went into the toilet and did a line of cocaine.
I'm Paul Scolfort, and this is Powerful. In this series, I come clean about my own sobriety and the journey it took for me to get here. In each episode, I will speak to a special guest about their addictions and how they achieve sobriety and how they maintain a happy lifestyle today. On today's podcast, I'm really excited to talk to Anita Chelimar, who is a therapist with over 3 decades of experience with trauma and addiction therapy. She currently works at the Priory and she has her own practice and has helped thousands of people in the UK to get over their addiction. Today we talk about her 36 years of sobriety. It's an incredible story, so please join us. So in some of these episodes, there will be discussions of alcohol misuse, drugs, sexual abuse, suicide, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. Anita, welcome to This Is Powerful.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming on.
Oh, thank you for asking.
You're very privileged. How long have you been sober?
I've been sober 36 years.
That's unbelievable.
Yes, it is.
How old was you when you got sober?
That's a really good question. It was 1988. So how old was I? 29.
Wow. What a lovely age to get sober. Kind of wish I got sober at that age.
Well, it wasn't expected. I didn't know I was going to do it. It really was weird how I just... What literally one day woke up and felt, I can't keep doing this.
Talking about waking up, let's go to the beginning.
Right.
Where are you from and how do you see your upbringing?
I'm from Newcastle upon Tyne, why I am, even though my Geordie accent is gone. It's completely gone because yeah. I came to London when I was 11, 12 and, you know, children want to fit in. We want to connect. And I didn't realise, but after about 3 months, children in my class were saying they didn't understand me at all for the first 3 months. And I come from Newcastle and my upbringing, oh, that's a real good question. My dad was originally born in Malaya, but he's Sri Lankan. And my mother is from Newcastle and they got married and split up when I was 7. So I'm mixed race. And so when I came to London, I went to live with my grandparents for 4 years because my parents separated. And then I came to London 11, 12.
Is that so they separated in Newcastle and then you come down?
Yeah. Well, they separated in Newcastle. My dad, he was a beautiful man in so many ways, but he had his own issues. He was really clever. He was a doctor. He was a dentist. He was a really clever man. And my mom was a designer. And the two of them got together. And from what I gather, after the day of their marriage, things changed and he became very controlling. I don't remember a lot of this. Mm. And through the work I've done, I've really seen the impact of what I went through as a child and the not remembering and why I didn't remember and how that's impacted me. But yeah, my parents separated when I was 7. I went to live with my grandparents with my mother for 4 years. My mother came to London after about a year. And she'd come up at weekends and I'd see my father twice a week. And it was really bizarre because he went from being this really apparently very controlling man to being, there was no rules. There was no, and my job was to work to get my mother back. So there was...
From your responsibility or from him?
From my responsibility in the sense of, so what I mean by that is when I go and visit him on a Tuesday and a Saturday, he would say, we've got to work to get your mum back. So my job from 7 years old was to work to get my mum back.
Wow, what pressure.
It was insane, really, when I look back. It was, and, you know, what I believe in with the work, without going forward into the work I do around trauma, but what I can see is I don't blame him because I see where he was coming from. But the impact on me as a child was huge because quite often, like with things like abusive situations, if it's like a physical, sexual, you know, abuse that people can tangibly go, oh my goodness, really sort of acknowledge. When it becomes like an emotional abuse or emotional neglect in some way, it's really hard to, as a person, sometimes to acknowledge that, because I minimized it for years.
Do you know, I can identify a little bit when my mum, I think I lost my nan when I was 7, and my father come in and was like, your nan just died, and that was it. I don't blame him either. He was that kind of guy. And about nearly 2 years later, my mum was taken to the London hospital, and we had no idea why. Mum had just disappeared. And I'm really close to my mum. And we'd asked Dad, and he said, she's gone away. She's just gone away. And I'm like, but she never goes away. What do you mean? And there was no explanation. So my sister and I were, you know, wondering what the hell was going on. And basically, I started to make dinners for my dad when he come home from work. It was about 9 months. And 2 months in, my dad sat on the bed after a phone call and kind of wept. I say kind of because he wasn't a weeper. And we're like, what's the matter? He goes, oh, your mum's going to be okay. She hasn't got cancer. And we're like, what do you mean? Well, I thought she was away working or something. And then we started to go to the hospital. But I became the mum of the household, so to speak, to look after my dad at that early age and cook and clean and do all those things.
A child will always adapt to what the parent needs without even knowing it. So that's sort of not... A parent might come from the place of thinking they're really trying to protect the child by not telling them, but a child has spidey senses. Like, you walk into a room and they'll pick up on things.
Yeah.
And if someone is saying, denying their reality and saying that isn't the case, then what happens is you grow up, you begin to doubt yourself because you have these really strong feelings, and yet someone's saying, no, that's not it. That's wrong.
Yeah.
When a child's reality is not sort of affirmed, what can happen is a child can grow up really doubting their own reality. And that sort of abandonment also at a young age. How old were you?
I would have just been four. I was around nine.
Okay. So that for a 9-year-old to all of a sudden, for that person to not be there, that is absolutely going to have impact. And you will have adapted into a way to survive that.
Well, I funny enough, I do. I've made a belief system to myself early on, I'm not sure exactly when, that I won't rely on anyone and I won't love anyone deeply because it only causes hurt. So I need to be self-reliant.
There you go.
And when I got married, my wife, she's so lovely. She's like, I'm going to cook dinner. I'm going to do this. I went, no, it's okay. I'll do my own dinner. I'll do my own laundry. And please don't iron my shirts because I know exactly how I like to do them. And she looked at me like I was crazy because she's Italian and she's obviously wants to do everything. But that comes from that, I believe. It's like a real kind of protect.
Absolutely.
Now that's gone because her whole family come in and cook and do stuff, which is wonderful. And it took a long time for me to adjust to let that go.
But it's really scary when a child, because you adapt as a young person, you adapt into a way to survive in the traumatic experience, you know, in the environment you're growing up in. And that plays out in adulthood, you know, and certain things that are affected, like my abandonment issues. You know, I would always be in relationships where I would, you know, the love addict, the love avoidant, you know, sort of like, you know, and that abandonment really, when I look back, because it was abandonment and enmeshment, my abandonment, like I felt my mom abandoned. I mean, she came to London to work, to try and build a home for me, to get money together, to get me to come to London. But at the same time, it felt like they split up at 7 and then I felt abandoned. We've talked about this since. But what happened was it sort of then that whole thing of it creates... abandonment ends up creating sort of love addiction because you end up putting people sort of like, you want to give me some attention? You want to give me some attention?
Yeah.
And, you know, because you feel that you're not getting that nurturing. And the enmeshment I had with my dad was, you know, it was really, I became very enmeshed with him because I became his partner, really, not in certain ways, but no, emotionally. Yeah. Emotionally.
Yeah.
And so what happened was I would then go towards people that were very needy to rescue. When you're enmeshed as a child with a primary caregiver, what happens is that those patterns are set up that you're the one, the overdeveloped sense of responsibility.
Yeah.
Right? I had an overdeveloped sense of responsibility. And so what would happen is I would be, without meaning to, I'd be looking... people who needed rescue, I'd be there. I'll rescue, but when people come towards you, it almost feels like a duty. It feels like suffocating. So pulling back at the same time. And what happens is when there's love avoidant, which creates a sort of a love avoidance, usually a love avoidant has intensity outside the relationship because they can't give themselves to the relationship. At the same time, when you've got someone who is a love addict, from coming from a place of abandonment. Now, and what I mean by that, the child, the energy should always go from the parent to the child, ideally, a healthy energy, parent to child. What happens is when the child is looking at the parent and the parent's looking away, and it doesn't mean the parent's a bad parent. It could be they're a single parent, they're working three jobs. It could be lots of reasons. But the child's looking to the parent, but they're not getting that nurturing. So then they look for that nurturing, that attention in life with other relationships. I used to have a real crossover of both of those because I had love avoidance and love addiction, if that makes any sense.
It does. For our listeners, because I'm familiar with the terms and obviously you're an expert in the terms, but for someone listening, what is love avoidance and love addiction and what's the characteristic, and does that come directly from the trauma you're talking about?
Yes. So, for instance, if, and it comes from I'm going to use another term, codependency.
Yeah.
So if you grow up in a dysfunctional home, or you grew up and there's been trauma in your life. So what happens is when a child is born, a child is just, is valuable. A child is enough just to be, just being Anita, just being Paul. We're enough, right? We're born, we're enough. We're a beautiful little baby, beautiful little boy, beautiful little girl. Now, when this is why I don't blame, it's not about blaming parents because people can only give what they've got. But when the primary caregiver, and I mean the parent, I'm going to use the word parent, when the parent, whether it's male or female, when the parent cannot acknowledge that child as being valuable for whatever reason, whether or not they feel they've got to, the child's got to be academic, the child's got to look a certain way, the child's got to be a certain way, that child grows up with a real sense of having to have other esteem because they don't have self-esteem. And what happens is when you don't have self-esteem, you then either go one down or you go one up, or 100 down, 100 up. You feel less than, or you might feel more than. Like you might have become the hero in your family because you became the little adult. It wasn't your job.
Yeah.
And I'm not, it's not about blaming your father, but actually your job was to be a child. It wasn't to be the parent looking after everyone. So what happens, we can become falsely empowered or we can become disempowered. And so if you are then falsely empowered or disempowered, quite often in relationships, and it doesn't just have to be romantic relationships, in any relationships, you might find that you become controlling or being controlled. And so that, straight away, that leads to a very not a balanced,
very imbalanced
interaction with someone. You're either above or below.
And does that person know that mentally at that time? Would you see that, obviously, if you're doing a lot of work, you'll probably get to see it later on, but as that person with low self-esteem, would you feel that and think, I have low self-esteem? Or does that just happen organically?
Well, I know, looking at myself, I didn't know I had low self-esteem, but I had it. I didn't know I had low self-esteem until I came into into recovery, until I stopped drinking and using, really, because I didn't, because I the outsides, because I was looking for other esteem and I had gifts and talents and I got things on the outside and they validated me, you know, having success in my work validated me. But I always remember sitting when one of the groups I was in, we got to number, I think it was number 6 in the chart. It was a big deal. And Lindsay, her mum, had a restaurant in Putney called Henrietta's. And I remember we sat in there for this celebration of number 6 in the charts. Isn't that amazing? And I'm sitting there going, yay. And then I went, what now?
Yeah.
And went into the toilet and did a line of cocaine.
Yeah.
You know, because it wasn't enough, because other esteem didn't fix me. Chasing other esteem kept me engaged to a certain extent. But once I got something...
Does that count for something that's prestigious or money or anything? Can that be any sort of object?
So any other esteem could be, it could be, for some people, it could be academic, like some people like I was talking to someone the other day who's been brought up in a very, very academic, their whole self-worth from this age was about what they could achieve.
Yeah, I have a few friends like that.
And the parents thought they were really doing great because they thought, you know, academia is knowledge, is power, is whatever in the society, you can achieve more. So they're thinking they're really helping the child, but actually from a young age, all the focus, instead of that child feeling that they've just got worth being them, they now need to achieve.
Yeah.
So when they aren't getting the grades that they feel they need to get, they are now depressed. They're now, my God, who am I? What am I? So it can be from the way, it could be for some people the way they look. I mean, for me, it was very much my lack of self-worth came from, my other esteem came from how I looked. And I always said, I could do this. But then don't walk behind. I can be a Hollywood set, but don't walk behind. There's nothing there. So I would always...
Sad, isn't it?
Yeah, because I'd always destroy relationships because I'd go, I could do this bit. And then if somebody engaged with me, I was like, but I've got nothing to offer.
Yeah.
You know?
I would do a really good shop front like what you're talking about because I generally wanted to. I think when I became a model and became really successful, the drive was on for me because I felt that this is my chance to get out of Dodge. And I just wanted to learn new places, new things. So I was from a nice place. Upminster is a nice place where I'm from. But I kind of had a small mentality around me. And it was quite prejudiced. And there was no understanding experience of life experiences, really. And so when I first started to model, I just saw the complete differences from what I was told, what I've seen. And I just wanted to have some of that. But as I got rewarded with good jobs and money and stuff, first of all, I thought this is great. It's like winning a lottery. I have arrived. But then that low self-worth started to catch up on me. And there was times when I had material things that I would only dream of. And someone would say to me, oh, you're so good looking, you know. And inside, I'd get this anger to think, are you insulting me? And it just made no sense. So I'm listening to you thinking, maybe we should have a few sessions.
But that anger, what was that anger? When you, now looking back, what was that anger?
Because I think it's a really good question. It depended because it's gone now and I actually can take a compliment. But at the time, I thought two things, either you're just valuing me on my looks and you don't know who I am, so like treat me like a piece of meat, or I don't believe you, you're just saying it just to say it, like, you know, and that's it, you know, or what would be interesting, I'd be in some relationships I went into, was definitely like fun girls on the jobs and stuff like that. But actually I was quite sensitive. So we'd go out and I'd be quite, want a deep conversation. I don't want to just talk about cars and jobs and stuff. And the girl would be like, oh, you're actually quite boring. I thought you'd be a bit more of a man, like, you know, like throw me around a bit and stuff in the bar. That's probably a bad example. So I almost felt like, oh my God, I don't want to be that person. I want to be me, but I've got to live up to what you see.
So you internally... That part of you internally knew, was aware that there was part of you that was really not being seen and heard.
Completely.
But you didn't know that. And so you would just get that feeling of feeling angry because people would be judging you on certain things. You think there's more to me, there's on some level.
Yeah, it almost like being having a nice dog, which I do have, and everyone's looking, you have such a lovely dog, but not seeing who you are. I love your dog. I want to get one of your dogs, and just leaving. And you're like, well, hello, what about me?
And that's a really hard place because the thing is, especially back in the day, I would imagine that esteem coming from the outside in and you were so successful and the way you looked and getting all that stuff. And then to feel on the inside that you didn't know who you were and to feel I sort of get a feeling of a sense of feeling quite lost.
Completely. When I went into the Priory, which I know you do trauma groups in, we did a collage one day to say, who do you think you are? Well, I bought in 10 sheets, obviously need to do more than everyone else. And I did this whole collage of... where I was
from. Could just have one sheet, 10 sheets.
Yeah, like everyone just sit down and watch. And I got them now. I still got them because they're quite sad. I looked at them and recently and I cried at some of them because I'm dyslexic, so it was easy for me to do it in pictures. And there was a couple of photos of me that I'd cut out of a magazine that was represented myself in a cage in my mind. And they were pretty horrendous. But they went through and I was like, am I this kid from my normal upbringing? Am I this sort of supermodel? Am I this actor? Am I this gymnast? Am I a boxer? And I looked at them all and I thought, God, who am I? Yeah. And now I know it's okay that I'm a little bit of everyone.
Yes. Isn't that beautiful?
It's amazing. But I couldn't see that. I don't know why I couldn't see it, because if someone represented that to me, it's quite obvious. But then I just didn't get it.
But maybe that was a scary thing, because when you say you couldn't see it, maybe there wasn't that ability to be able to have a solid foundation, to be able to plant all those things in there, that you became one or you became the other.
It's exactly that.
Because I did that.
Yeah.
I really did that. I had all these different facets, and I still do. And I know we're both Aquarians, and that's meant to be something as well.
We're in trouble.
but it was sort of like I'd be different things for different people. And that was the most amazing thing at my engagement party. And I really did. I mean, I didn't want an engagement party, but I didn't. And I was so scared because I thought, oh my God, all these people from all walks of life are going to come together. But it was the most beautiful thing. So I love my husband, and we had this engagement party, and it was just beautiful because I was the same person with everybody.
That must have been an incredible moment, because for me, I had my fashion friends, even in the business, I had fashion friends, catalog friends, commercial friends, and I had my guys I used to love driving with, motorbike friends, boxing friends. And for some reason, I thought they could never meet, because it would be disastrous for me. And when I finally got everyone in the same room, I sat back and watched everyone just talk and have fun. And I was like, oh, years.
Well, it was interesting because I had people that were really close to me, and I've still got my people who are like my family to me. And they've known me all the way, you know, all the way through, really, from about 1920. Both of them actually said, you shouldn't drink. You can't drink. Anyway, that's another story, which I know we should probably go into. But the thing, there was one person that came to that engagement party who was very much in the thinking of my old thinking, which was very much in the sense of, you know, you have to be a certain way. And and I heard them say to someone, this is boring. And initially it wounded. And then I thought, no, if this is boring, I'll do boring. Because I just felt really, I feel quite emotional. For one, I was with my husband. And I always said I'd never get married, never have children. And I said that because of where I came from, from the childhood stuff. And to be able to be there and to have that feeling of, yes, it wounded, because I do. I don't sit here and say I don't get affected by things. Of course I get affected by things. But the beauty there is I can look at it and go, okay, this hurts because this part of me is being wounded. This is triggering that younger part. The work I do and the work that I've done on myself is there's certain parts of me, certain ages that I know when I'm being triggered and what that means. So I always say it's a bit like, you know, if you do step work, different work, and you go to it's a bit like a computer file. You can go click, click, click. It's the A to Z for people who
like
are older
the
viewers.
Of yourself.
For people who are younger, you don't know what an A to Z is. It's where you used to look in a book that used to help you learn Streets of London. But look at myself.
Yeah, and it's so a whole mapping system of yourself.
Yeah, a mapping system. Yeah. So I can do that now. And it's not that I don't get hurt, but it's the fact that was the first time I think of that engagement party that I really realized, yes, I felt hurt by an old way of life that somebody from there came and found it, what I was, mind game, boring. But the people that really mattered, that loved me for me, not what I did, how I look, whatever like that, but loved me for me, loved it, you know? Yeah. And I was able to move back into that place.
Which is once wholesome.
Yes, absolutely.
When did you take your first drink?
I took my phone. Well, we had alcohol, apparently, when I was quite young, we had alcohol.
Because your mum or dad drunk? Or was
my
just
dad
in the
didn't,
house?
But my mum would have a glass of wine. But I took my phone. I mean, I started drinking between 12 and 14. I did it quite young. Because my mother had this, she'd had quite a strict upbringing. I love my grandma. She was an Irish lady who was quite feisty and very, very, just amazing. I loved her. But she had a strict upbringing, my mum. And she believed that if you give somebody responsibility, that they'll take it.
And run.
So I came to London and she was quite bohemian in a sense that we had our front, I mean, it was quite a white, black plastic and white leather walls and turquoise. I mean, it was very out there and it was in Leytonstone in our flat. And my friends would come from school and I just wanted a table with fruit on it. Like, you know, sort of like a three-piece suite. I wanted really sort of normal. And my mom was very, you know, she was very creative. And my friends loved it. I would get so embarrassed. And that something else. Anyway, that's another story. But I took my first drink. She used to make wine as well. And so I drank and I'd like, you know, I'd fill her bottles of things up. Like I didn't know.
Did she know you was drinking?
She knew I drank. She knew I drank from quite a young age. I don't think she realized to the extent, but I used to go out underage. I used to go into the West End underage. Yeah. I mean, I really, when I look back.
A little bit normal back then though, wasn't it? If you could go in somewhere and wouldn't have to have ID and just going if you knew someone or you looked cool.
Well, I just used to, but when I look at like my son, who, you know, when he was 12, 13, 14, and I saw the age he was and I think, well, I was walking out dressed up with, you know, whatever, going into the West End.
Oh, at 12?
Well, between, I'd say probably about 14, 15.
Yeah, that's young.
Yeah. But 12, I would start drinking and I was, you know, my tell friends, we'd tell each other's parents we were staying at each other's house and end up in Wanstead flats drinking with people that I shouldn't be drinking with. You know, there was a lot of, there was a lot happened.
When you first drunk though, did you feel that it kind of, people talk about it fills a hole or it makes them feel stronger, important, more prettier, better, whatever. Was there an immediate effect?
I don't know about the immediate effect, but I do know that it filled the cracks. I felt I could communicate. I felt I could be. When I drank, I could be with people. You know, when I didn't drink, it's interesting because like Brad and Lynette are like my brother and sister. They just love them to bits. They always wanted me to get sober. Brad pointed out when I was 19, you know, about me not drinking and Lynette acknowledged it as well. And the reason when I wasn't drinking, I would be around them because they felt safe.
So you had like safe friends and then you'd just go and leave them if you
were
drinking.
And Lynette wouldn't drink when she went out with me and she would, because she didn't know what was going to happen, didn't know where I'd be, what would happen. So, they really cared for me. And, yeah, I would just, you know, once I started, that was it. You know, it just carried on and carried on. And it is a progressive illness and it just got worse and worse and worse. So I'm just so grateful that I had that moment of clarity, as they talk about. I was one of the first presenters on Sky Tracks. And I remember they were getting rid of people and they were closing it down and we it wasn't that they got rid of me because of my drinking.
Yeah.
Because I didn't drink when I worked. But what happened was my attitude, I was becoming belligerent. I was becoming insecure. I was becoming paranoid. So I could see that, you know, they were suggesting things because it was early days of Sky and they were suggesting ideas for me, which would have probably helped me grow. And I'm like, no, 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 you know, and what happened was they ended up closing the music side of it because I did the first ever music video awards with Gary Davis and we did some great, amazing stuff. But they were suggesting things and I'm going, no, no, no. And in the end, they closed the channel and I was one of the first presenters they got rid of. And when I look back, you know, I can really understand why.
Yeah.
And it was sad. For a long time, I struggled. I really struggled in early days of sobriety because, you know, I'd had this sort of career and then I got sober and I had nothing. I was in Wilson County Court for taxes unpaid in the 80s. I didn't drive. I didn't have any money. I didn't have a partner. I didn't have anything. And all of a sudden people were telling me when I came into recovery and getting clean and sober to be grateful, you know, and I remember thinking, be grateful, yeah. Be grateful.
Do you know where I just come from? Did you not see my last job?
Yeah, and then having to go, and I remember in Kensal Rise, the health shop had a signed photo of me on their wall. And I went in there just to ask them for a job because I needed money. I had no money.
You must have felt, was that your emotional rock bottom? Like you felt like you just lost everything
was
the end.
It was, you know what, the lady who helped me said to me, you'll be really grateful that you've got all the time to work at your recovery and to focus on you getting well. And I remember thinking, she's mad. Why have I asked her? Because why would I be grateful for this? But she was right, because I was the type of person, when I look back, I've got high energy at times and I would be off. I'd be off. And what it made me do was really stay put and work at getting how to live in the world clean and sober. And I do believe from the age I started drinking and using, I stopped growing emotionally. So I was a 29-year-old with the emotional makeup of a 12, 13,
But that's a common theme, right? They talk about it in recovery, in the rooms that people share, that when they started to use drugs or drink or love addiction or food addiction, they stopped.
My experience is from myself and from working with other people that when people start really getting into recovery, they really feel they've sort of like regressed or suppressed both, really. The age, all of a sudden they're feeling, because most people feel lost when they first get sober. If you're really connecting with recovery, I think you really do. There's a sense of feeling lost. You might feel amazed. Like my first bit of serenity was sitting in Queen's Park with my flatmate and the dog and sitting there, and all of a sudden all those voices weren't going over in my head, you know, because if people asked me anything, I'd be second guessing them. What do you mean by that? And all of a sudden I was just sitting in the sunlight with, you know, and I had no money. I had no job. I had no relationship. I didn't have anything that would other esteem that I talked about. I just was me. And for the first time ever, I remember having about 2-3 minutes of feeling okay. And I thought, I found out that's what serenity is, right? So to feel comfortable in your own skin. And I realized that that's something that you can't actually, it just has to come from the inside out, from the work you do.
Do you know what? It's so lovely to hear, because when people talk about addicts or alcoholics, my first experience was seeing someone, when I went to see my mum actually, in Whitechapel, on the floor in an old brown coat, begging for 10 pence to go towards some liquor. And I said to my dad, give him 10 pence, he looks really in need. And my dad said, well, he'll only drink on it. I didn't understand what he meant. And sure enough, he gave him 10 pence and then we went, come back, and the guy was swearing at my dad, he was all over the place, and he was drinking like complete spirits. And really, when you hear, as you go into recovery, you hear about the noise in the head, the voices in the mind, and that sounds quite scary when, unless you've experienced it. But in my first year, I did the same. I didn't work. I was lucky enough to take time off. And part of the healing process, going through the steps, I went back to my flat one time and sat there to really think if I'm doing this properly, the recovery part. And all of a sudden, I realized that there's no noise, like there's actual quiet. And my body started to weep. It was a very weird experience. And I literally walked from one room to the other to make sure it was me. And then I realized how busy my head had been before. And it kind of lasted for about 2 days. I thought I was fixed at that point, but it lasted for 2 days. And I'm glad I had that experience, because for me, it was kind of like somewhere to aim towards. So now I aim towards to try and be serene, where before, where's the chaos? I'm going to go to there. But to understand, have that experience where you can see your mind so busy to complete silence is incredible. So now I understand why people meditate and want to have a quiet mind, because before it was a distraction to my feelings. Is that commonplace for people that you work with?
I believe in the individual. Because I believe even with addiction, people are linked with addiction, but everyone's a unique individual with a backstory, their own individual backstory. So I tend to work with, you know, obviously I treat the addiction and I look at the addiction, but also then when I will delve into not huge amounts of trauma at the beginning, because you've got to have a foundation to support that. Yeah. But I think it's really important that you to be able to start seeing where if somebody's getting triggered, they may be getting triggered because of some trauma that's happened in their childhood, or they may be getting triggered because, you know, the family, they're in their, you know, sometimes people are with their, the people they actually have created the trauma, and they may be living with those people. Yeah. And so it's beginning to be able to identify what parts of them are being triggered and just, what age.
Just want to know, I know what triggered means. Okay. But for listeners who don't know what triggered means, what does it actually mean?
So for instance, if you... say I'm walking down the street and I, well, I'll give this an example. There was somebody many years ago, I worked with somebody and I couldn't get it out. For some reason, this person just, I would have this really strong reaction to them. And when I looked at that, they reminded me of somebody that I had a really bad experience with years ago. And the trigger is the impact of being taken back. So, like, for instance, we could be talking now and we talk about past trauma and the chemicals are coming down from the brain and, you know, we're talking about trauma, but we're not actually in the trauma.
Yeah.
But sometimes people actually become what they call the wound. They become the trauma. And when you think about what's happening is... sorry, I hope I'm not being too complicated here, because I'm trying to keep it really simple. Because what happens is the trauma that you're triggered by something and you become back in that place.
Mentally and physically and emotionally.
Yeah, and what happens is sometimes people will go, I don't know what happened to me. And they may feel really scared about that. And it's actually a really normal reaction to an abnormal situation. Yeah. And that's what I try and do when I work with people, is to try and make, because people think, oh, I'm weird, I'm strange, I've got this going on. No, you actually adapted in a way that's really amazing, because you adapted to survive. And so this isn't abnormal. This is a normal reaction to a really abnormal situation. So it's beginning to normalize the reaction and why you do it and seeing it and not to be scared of it.
Which is really powerful, because if you're not aware, I mean, most of us aren't taught any of this at school or for our families. And when people said that some of my reactions was like that, it was a huge relief, because I thought, oh my God, I'm normal. Like, I'm not crazy.
No.
And now I understand I can deal with that, because I've done well. I've lived to my circumstances. And the tools, someone said to me really wisely that the toolkit you're using now, he said to me, this was in New York, because I was triggered by trauma that kept coming up. And I went to see this guy who's incredible. His name's Abdi Asadi. He's an acupuncturist, but he's got some more stuff going on. Yeah. He's very intuitive. And I went to see him and I sat there and he said, you know, what's going on? And I started to talk to him just before the acupuncture session. And all he did was move my foot slightly out, the other one out, and just push me back a little bit. And I burst out crying.
Oh, wow.
He said, that's where you need to be. It blew me away. And he said, what you are, he said, you're like a samurai warrior. You've got all the kit, the sword, the bow and arrow and everything. You're an amazing, efficient fighter, but you're way out of date. And it's like you're in a swimming pool and that stuff's going to make you sink now. So you need to take all the armor off and be in your vulnerability, because that's your strength.
Mm-hmm.
And it blew me away. And I really tried to be in that vulnerability, which is not easy all the time, but I've realized why it's a strength to let people in, to have communication, especially like with my children, to love them and feel that love and not be afraid of it, you know, is incredible if you've experienced that, you know.
Absolutely. And also what you just said, it's like something, a similar thing. It's like being a moving target. Before, I'd be like, you know, and this was given to me, and it's sort of a similar but different, in the sense of like when you're being this, when you're not telling anyone who you are, because you're frightened of being hurt, arrows are flying all the time and you're getting hurt. But actually, when you tell somebody, actually, this hurts me, when I hear you do that, when you do that, this is how I feel. And if the arrows still fly, you actually then go, well, why is that arrow flying? Why is that happening? And I found I got hurt less. And it's the irony, isn't it? The more vulnerable I am and can be, the less I get hurt. And today I'm not saying I don't care about getting hurt. Of course I do. I don't want to be, but I'm not afraid of being hurt. I'd rather not be hurt, by the way.
Yeah.
But I'm not afraid, because I've survived it and I've come through it. And that all that energy that goes into trying to build that armor you're talking about, to keep yourself safe and to actually gently dismantle. And I think gently dismantling, for some people, it might be quite abrupt, depending where you are in your recovery, I think, as yeah. well.
What? So you found sobriety. It sounded incredibly difficult, but I mm-hmm. believe those things build up resilience and they're great, because when you're left with nothing, you get to look at everything, you know, and you get to see your past, what you want, what you desire, what you don't want, where your ego is. And how was the first sort of couple of years of recovery, and when did you get into being a therapist? They were clearly good.
They were so painful. But, you know, I'm so grateful. Now I'm grateful. The first few years, it was really hard. Because the thing is, I thought I was fearless, and I discovered fear when I got sober. I became bulimic when I got sober. I, you know, you name it. It was like going to one of those things at the fun fair. That's it. You're an addict? Oh, alcohol? Oh, no, you've got about another 3 billion addictions that you need to. But I'm so grateful, because what was given to me, how I was guided, was by a beautiful, beautiful, she was in my life for like 30 odd years. And she took me to my first, you know, bit of recovery.
How did you guys meet?
Through ringing up for help. She got back to me. And she was just gentle. She was a gentle, beautiful woman who, up until the day she died, I didn't even know how many people she'd helped. She really was the one person that I can think of who walked a walk and really demonstrated humility.
Yeah.
Because she just helped people. And I remember I would go and do what I did to stay sober, with other people who are doing the same thing as me. And then I would I remember going to the Lighthouse, because my flatmate, his ex-partner, was leaving the Lighthouse, and I had no money. I had no qualifications, because my last 2 years at school, I was bunking off. I was drinking. I was doing everything. So apart from being a performer, and all of a sudden, no one's knocking at my door going, "We really want you, Anita." Yeah. So I was like, "Oh my gosh, I'm going to have to pay bills. Oh my God, I'm going to have to eat. I didn't even know how to go to the supermarket and buy stuff from us. I mean, it was. I felt like a child, and I went to, and anyway, this guy had left the Lighthouse. The London Lighthouse was an incredible, incredible place, because it was for people who had HIV and AIDS in the early 90s. And at that point, people were dying all the time coming in. And I remember Elton John gave his the single Sacrifice, all his money to, and it was the most zhuzhy place. It was like ridiculous place. It wasn't ridiculous. It was the most amazing place.
For those who don't know, where was the Lighthouse?
So the London Lighthouse was in Ladbroke Grove.
Yeah.
And so you go there, and it was just beautiful, because at that point, people who had HIV and AIDS were absolutely being treated horrifically. And so
this was a centre for addiction to help people.
Oh, no, this wasn't about addiction. Sorry, this was about HIV and AIDS.
Got it.
So I'd gone to work there. I haven't been talking much about addiction, actually. No, I've just realised that. So I'd gone to work there, and it was cleaning. And I was like, okay, a few months ago, I'm swanning around doing what I'm doing, and now I'm cleaning. So I got the name changed to residential unit assistant. not that I'm grandiose or anything, but it was the most incredible place. It was humbling, because I got to. They ended up paying a third of my counselling training. So I, by being there and by being involved, and I don't ask me how, I got to go on the counsellors' week with their training, and there was a beautiful person there who made me want to be. A therapist was a guy called Ben Keaveney, and he was an Irish guy who'd worked with children with cancer and also worked on the streets in Dublin with addicts. And he was the lead therapist, and he just inspired me. And he became sort of the person that sort of, I really want to do this work. I didn't know I wanted to do this work.
That's amazing, though, to find that from where you come from.
Yes.
From being broken to then finding your new path.
Yes. And so I didn't train till I was 6 years sober, because I was really scared. My early recovery, I was very scared of life. And then went and did that and then trained and became a therapist. And then since 1998, I've worked in addiction in all different places, about 11 treatment centres, day programmes, residential programmes, one-to-ones.
Because I know you worked at One North East, which is a charity, and all the way up to the taking groups at the Priory and UCAT as well, which are huge places.
Absolutely. Well, I do now. I do. I've got my own practice, but I also get, like, I do the Priory. I support people, get people prepared and support them after the trauma programme, as well as delivering the trauma programme. I also still work with people who are, you know, addicts who are leaving the Priory. I work for UCAT. I worked at Sanctuary Lodge, and UCAT are a huge provider for addiction. Yeah.
They've got like 175 beds, right?
They've got places all over, all over England. And now they've just opened a place off Harley Street, and I do the step down program for them and do the family group. And then I do my own family group. I run a family group. And then there's another organization called Prime Counseling. I do DBT groups online for them. And Castle Craig up in Scotland, they contact me to work with people when they've left treatment. So and then different people contact me, different psychiatrists and different people refer me clients. So I'm very grateful, because I went from, you know, I've been employed, and then to make that step to be, you know, I'd always done self-employed as well as, but I'd never just left and had my own practice and just be my own person with it. But I love working with addiction and trauma, really.
A question I've always asked is, if you have trauma as a child, does it guarantee that you're going to be an addict? And if not, how do people deal with their traumas? Because most people, like Gabor Mate talks about, 51% of addicts have experienced some sense of trauma. Mm. Can you have trauma and not become an addict or an alcoholic?
Well, I've worked with people who are being referred to me who aren't referred for addiction, but they have trauma. But what I've found, my experience is, what you find is there is a way of medicating the trauma. Now, whether or not, so it might not be out and out addiction, but there may be other ways of medicating. But there is a way of not adapting in the world to manage the trauma.
Right.
So what I do is, when I start working with someone, I will start looking at their family of origin. I look at their history and start really, and look at why they feel they need to come and see someone like me. And then work backwards from that, because I work with people. I don't believe in working at people. I work with someone. And, you know, what I tend to find, there may be a sliver of addiction somewhere, because usually when people are wanting to medicate pain, there becomes quite usually a way of wanting to medicate the pain. It might not be alcohol, it might not be drugs, it might be work, it might be, there's an element of addiction there. But there is, that I have worked with people who, you know, when you look at mood disorders, you know, if someone becomes depressed or is anxious or other types of, you know, other types of emotional disorders, people might end up, that's the path they go into.
Yeah.
So it might not always be out and out just addiction, or there may be slivers of something in now and again. But I'm always very open-minded, because I think now, working with addiction and working with trauma and seeing, you know, I've learned so much and keep learning. I learn from clients. I mean, you know, I really do. You know, there was a wonderful person I was working with who everybody thought they were, you know, very strange, and they'd grown up feeling they were, because they had certain types of behaviours. But their gifts that came from those behaviours that they could hold on to, and all of a sudden start seeing themselves not as being strange, but actually they've got these gifts, but they've also got certain parts of their personality that may be working against them. And to be able to look at that and work with that, and also some people have just changed careers, because even though they may have been drawn to certain careers, maybe where they're at to be healthy to do that, which is, I know for me that happened in a way. To be healthy, I needed to make decisions to go to certain places where I wanted to be over here, but actually I had to be honest about who I am and go, yeah, if you go over there, you're probably going to use and drink again. So just stay over here for now and be grateful.
I'm smiling because I lived in Hollywood for 5 years of my sobriety. Wrong. I auditioned for Spartacus, and I got down to the last two out of 18,000 people.
No.
I auditioned in London, LA and New York. Flew me in to do the audition, which was amazing. It was really humbling. And I really felt that this was me, this whole part. But on set, we did the second scene. It was all going well. And I had this loud voice in my head saying, literally, you can't do this. And I was like, where did that come from? And I had the overwhelming feeling that for me, I would end up using if I moved there for a 5-year contract away from my stuff. And you know, the guy, they had a guy in camp who got the job anyway. He was amazing. But it was a really interesting feeling. And I had a pull to move away from Hollywood and come back to London because I needed to be safe. And it was more about sobriety for me and a sort of drive towards a charity we do, Stride Foundation, something like that. I didn't know at the time, but I felt gutted. I was like, I want to go back and have a Bentley and the house in the hills and all these nice things. But it made, it would turn me into the person I don't want to be, you know?
I think that's so important because it's so important who you're talking to at that point. Because if you're, you know, sometimes people with the best intentions and where your recovery is at that point, because we've got, what do you mean you're not going to do X, Y, and Z? But actually you have, you know, as an addict, you know, you're that sense of, I mean, how long were you around at that point?
I think, gosh, what was that? I'm not sure, 10 years maybe.
Okay. So at that point, there was a real sense of knowing, you had a sense of self at that point, yeah. I make up, right?
Yeah.
So you,
I was fighting it.
Yeah.
I was really fighting it.
I get it.
Because I had the opportunity and I was like, I should do this, but I don't.
I hadn't even got to the point of getting the job, but I remember getting it and it was, oh my God, what's it called? It was an Asian musical in the West End. And I got, I went and auditioned for it. My son was 4 months, 2 months, 3 months old. And they called me back for the recall. And I know Mira Sayal, who I adore, went and did it for a week. But I got called back. And I remember saying to the agent at the time, because they said it was 6-month contract or a year's contract. And my son, who I just love, and, you know, and every night, I would have my rocking chair and I had my little routine and I hold him and I sing him to sleep. And we read, I read him and come on. We just go, can I just go to sleep, Mum? And I knew that if I went and did that job, I would be missing out on, I think it was 6 months or a year of that. And in my mind, I just went, there is nothing more precious than being a mother to my son and being here. Yeah. And I remember that and I was like, whoa, because I really wanted to be doing something like that. But I actually, I think that's what surprised me because a friend of mine said to me, I said, you know, sometimes I think, am I just frightened and I don't go and do X, Y, and Z? And she said, she said, once you put your mind to something, Anita, you really put your mind to it. I think what surprised me was how I've changed in my decisions when things come up. And like you said, what you knew at that point, for you to stay safe, because the most precious gift is recovery. As an addict, the most precious thing is to be clean and sober.
Well, if you lose that, you lose everything.
Absolutely.
Completely.
So for you to know that if you went and did that, at that point, you might have used.
I think I would. You're such an, I could just sit here forever, honestly. You're amazing, your knowledge. And it's really important, I think, for people to understand that no matter where you're from and your addiction, you become like one of the best counsellors in town doing trauma courses. It's incredible.
Thank you.
What would you say to people listening to this podcast that either feel that they have addiction problems, they're going down that road, or someone close to them is, what's the first thing they should do?
What I feel is the most important thing you can do if you feel that you've got a problem with addiction is reach out for help. Reach out. And even if you don't, what was said to me, if I'd waited to feel like an addict, I'd be dead by now, because as soon as I thought, am I an addict? My head would go, no, you're not an addict because you don't do this and you don't do that. Just reach out for help and just stick with it a day at a time. Just stick with it. Because what I do believe, and I do think sometimes, you know, anybody who's been, because some people come into recovery from different places. Some people come in and they don't trust. And for people to say, trust, I always say to people, you don't have to trust a human, trust the process.
Yeah.
There is absolute a demonstration of millions of people in the world right now who are doing a process of recovery and staying sober. And so for anyone who's got a problem, please just reach out for help and give it a good go. Just go, because all the right things feel wrong, the wrong things feel right. Everything you want to do is going to take you back to using, and everything you don't want to do is probably going to take you to recovery. Yeah. So stick with it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for asking. It's been lovely, Paul. Thank you.
This podcast is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also make a donation. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. And if you enjoyed This Is Powerful, please rate, review, and follow the podcast to share it with your friends, your family, anyone you can, and head over to social media. I always love to see and hear how you react to the episodes, and it's so helpful for our content to be shared. A big thank you to Anita for today. And if you want to find anything about the work she does, please check the show notes. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica and Marty, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Henry, you know who you are, and to Emma Long, who does all the hard work in the background. And there's a whole catalogue of episodes wherever you get your podcasts. But did you know you can also watch it on YouTube? Just search for This Is Powerful with Paul Scholfer.
I'm Elizabeth Day, the creator and host of How to Fail. It's the podcast that celebrates the things in life that haven't gone right and what, if anything, we've learned from those mistakes to help us succeed better. Each week, my guests share three failures, sparking intimate, thought-provoking and funny conversations. You'll hear from a diverse range of voices sharing what they've learned through their failures. Join me Wednesdays for a new episode each week. This is an Elizabeth Day and Sony Music Entertainment original podcast. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.